to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. It's your slice of gaming life from Tokyo. I'm your host, Mono. The New Year holiday is over in Japan, but at least we've got a lot of games to look forward to in 2023, and a lot of great podcast episodes, including this one that you're listening to right now. On today's episode, I'm joined by fellow Tokyo resident, Kit Shoryuken, to talk about Japanese arcades. We talk about what makes a good arcade, our go-to games, and whether or not you should be allowed to punch the cabinet. And I actually dove into my backlog and played through Pikmin 3 Deluxe, so I'll share my thoughts as the prodigal son to the Pikmin series, plus mid-game thoughts on the old-school SRPG Tactics Ogre Reborn. Let's jump right into the feature on Japanese arcades with Kit Shoryuken. This episode's feature is all about Japanese arcades. Video game arcades may be few and far between in most parts of the world, but in Japan, they are still abundant, with both classic and modern games you can play. Joining me to chat about Japan's arcades is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jim, and I also go by Kid Shoryuken on various social media sites. And I'm a YouTuber, and I have been covering video games and sort of Japanese gaming culture for over 10 years now.
Thanks for joining me today. Let's do a bit of table setting here. How would you describe a typical Japanese arcade?
A typical Japanese arcade would consist mostly of a lot of crane games, maybe also some picture booths and things like that, purikura as they're called. And you would probably also find quite a few, maybe some rhythm games, and some that kind of incorporate collective card games as well. Not a lot of Japanese arcades feature a lot of the games that I like to play, which are typically a lot of fighting games or shoot 'em ups, and I'm also more of a retro gamer. Most arcades won't feature those kinds of games. It'll be kind of stuff that can pull in money from a younger crowd, which again is mostly prize games and maybe some rhythm games and things like that mostly.
Japan has numerous chain arcades like Taito's Game Station and Gigo, formerly Sega. Do you have a preference among these, or do they all kind of feel the same?
I tend to go with Gigo, but I'm kind of particular. Like, there are certain ones that I like. So, for example, in Akihabara, there are three or four Gigo arcades. And in each one, like I said, they're mostly crane games and, you know, prize games, things like that. Stuff I'm not too terribly interested in, but it seems like in each one there's at least one floor that I will like to go to. So, for example, I think in Gigo Building Number 3, on the sixth floor is what they call Retro G, and it's strictly a retro arcade with games from the 80s and 90s, and I think there are even some older games in there, like maybe something from like the late 70s. So I'll typically go there. If I'm going to go to a Gigo arcade in Akihabara, I'll go to that one. Likewise, one of them has a floor where you can go and play pinball and darts and things like that. And I like that kind of stuff too. I like pinball. So usually though, I will go with a Gigo arcade just because they might have something like that in there. Maybe some sort of throwback to maybe like retro Sega. Or they'll have some of the, I believe they're called Nessica live cabinets, where they'll have a whole assortment of games that you can choose from. And they'll typically have a lot of shoot 'em ups and fighting games, and even some indie games, too, that you can try out. So, yeah, typically I'll go to Gigo, I would say, formerly the Sega arcades.
Yeah, one thing that surprised me about a lot of the even big-name arcades is that they often have retro games in them. It's not uncommon to pop by even like a Taito Game Station, and you're able to play something like King of Fighters 98. Why do you think there's an effort to mix both old and new games?
Because there are going to be people in my age range or older that have kind of a nostalgic connection to games like that. In particular, I'm a 90s kid, so growing up, going to when I did get the chance to go to an arcade at home, Mostly what we would play would be stuff like that, like Street Fighter, or maybe if you were lucky enough, they had King of Fighters or X-Men versus Street Fighter or something. And then a lot of the emerging 3D games at the time, Virtua Fighter and the Light Gun games and things like that. So if you want to attract me to an arcade, you'll have something in there from, you know, the 80s or the 90s, because that's what I'm going to want to play. So I think it would be wise to have a mix of things that like younger and older crowds would like to play. Typically, like on the first handful of floors, like a Taito or a Gigo, the first like two or three floors will be mostly the prize redemption games. And I think that's where mostly the younger crowds and couples and young girls like to go and play. And then maybe if you go up on some of the higher floors, that's where you get to some of the stuff that I'd like to play, which again, it's like what you might say, like quote unquote, typical arcade games, fighters and shoot 'em ups and quarter munchers, things like that.
Out of everything, which arcades in Tokyo would you personally recommend?
I would recommend the Mikado game centers. There's two of them. There's one in Takadanobaba, which is the original Mikado. And there's also a location in Ikebukuro. And they offer a wide variety of games from the 80s and 90s. And in particular, they have a lot of fighting games. And they tend to hold tournaments and things like that. They do a lot of live streaming. They have their own YouTube channels for their various arcades. And they live stream fighting game competitions. They live stream super plays of shoot 'em up games and things like that. So that's all really fun. And also, I would recommend in Takadanobaba, there is sort of a third Mikado location called, I believe it's called the Retro Game Museum, where they have a lot of early 80s arcade machines. So if you like things like Donkey Kong or Pac-Man or Xevious or Breakout, things like that, they have a lot of that. And then in the basement, they have a lot of pinball machines and some other things down there, like Punch-Out, Gauntlet, and a few old light gun games. So that one's really great. And then if you're in Akihabara, like I said, they have those various Gigo and Taito arcades, but the absolute best one is called Taito Hei, which is H-E-Y, the Hirose Entertainment Yard. And on their second and third floors, they have a lot of classic arcade games, classic shoot-em-ups, and even some platformers. And then on the third floor, they just have a lot of fighting games from the 90s and 2000s, even more modern stuff like Street Fighter V, which there aren't a whole lot of Street Fighter V arcade cabinets out there, and Tekken 7, things like that. So modern fighters, retro fighters, and a whole lot of retro games on the second floor. So that's my favorite one in Akihabara, and I would say all of those combined, Taito Hei, the various Mikado locations, those would be my recommendations if you're in Tokyo and you want to go to a really good arcade and you want to skip all the fluff, all of the crane games and things. Those are the ones I would recommend going to.
Yes, in my first ever episode, I featured the Mikado Game Center, and I definitely agreed that it's very unique and one of the best in Tokyo, especially even though they're old games, they cycle out their collection pretty frequently.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it'll be a long lapse in time when I actually have an opportunity to go to Mikado. And usually it's a surprise to go in there and see like what they have maybe this year that they didn't have last year, or even if they rearrange machines sometimes to accommodate something different, pinball, for example, they'll have in there sometimes. So it's always, fun to go in there and see what they've added or taken or changed or what have you.
What do you think separates a good arcade from a great one? Is it simply the number of games, or is there something more?
I would say it's the number of games, but it's also a variety of good games. That's why a place like Mikado is fun to go to, because like I said, they do have a lot of fighting games. And I think a lot of people, they'll think of Mikado as like a place to go to play fighting games competitively, but they also have just a lot of beat 'em ups and shoot 'em ups and like old platformers and puzzle games, light gun games, racing games, the F-Zero arcade, and like maybe Ridge Racer, Daytona USA. Having a big variety of games is really important. That's one of the reasons I like Retro G in Akihabara, is because they break it down like 80s games, 90s games, but there's just There's so much. So if you like driving games, they have a lot of those, from classic OutRun to Crazy Taxi and Daytona and Ridge Racer. They have a bunch of shoot 'em ups, a bunch of cocktail cabs, which are fun if you want to play Donkey Kong or something to that effect, even like some prize redemption things. It's a nice mix of things. So if you're, just tired for whatever reason that day of Street Fighter or Gradius or whatever it is, you can go play Crazy Taxi or something. And so the number of games is important, but also the quality of the games and a nice variety. Because if I did go to an arcade where literally all they had was fighting games, I'd probably get, a little tired of it eventually. Sometimes I want to play a beat 'em up or something. So yeah, that's important. A nice variety will keep me there. And again, as I said, any arcade that has pinball, which they're kind of few and far between now, I'll always be happy to find some pinball.
So we've talked up the buildings, but let's look at the games. When you visit an arcade in Tokyo, what is your go-to game?
The games I want to play the most are probably going to be shoot 'em ups. That could be something like Gradius or R-Type or a Danmaku shooter like Dodonpachi or a Kai Katana, anything by Cave. I tend to gravitate to those just because I've liked shooters for a really long time, most of my life. I like the simple and challenging gameplay. Aside from that, though, I do play quite a lot of fighting games. In particular, I really like Street Fighter and Tekken. So whenever I can, I like to sit down for a game of Tekken or Street Fighter, either playing against the CPU or another player. And aside from that, when that's all, I'm tired of that, a good beat 'em up will always suffice. Because again, that's kind of mindless and simple, and they're challenging, fun. And then a good driving game will usually be how I wrap it up. If they have Crazy Taxi, I'm going to play Crazy Taxi. If they don't have that, I'll play something else, though. And again, on the rare occasion that there's pinball, I'll go play some pinball. But those usually cost a little more, though, unfortunately. Whereas most games, they'll be like 100 yen a play. Sometimes the pinball machines are up to like 200 or 300 yen, which I don't necessarily know why that is. Presume maybe because pinball machines are more expensive to like buy and operate and maintain than a standard candy cab or something. Not really sure, but usually my go-to first thing I'll sit down and play will be a shoot 'em up.
Within a single arcade, there's a lot of sections in games aimed at specific subcultures. You've got your fighting game area, your shooter area, your music game area, even very particular Japan-centric sections like quiz games and horse racing. What were some games you discovered after stepping into an arcade that you ended up loving?
I guess some of the shoot 'em ups, some of the more fun bullet hell shooters, just because that's not something that was really very common to find in an arcade when I was a kid. It was growing up as a kid, I was always a console gamer just because I didn't grow up in an area where there were a lot of arcade games. Well, not an arcade at least. If you went to maybe a Walmart or something, maybe in the lobby, they would have a few arcade games. Or if you were lucky enough to go to the shopping mall or the movie theater, they'd have a few games to play. So most of what I played as a kid was all console stuff, and that was mostly how I would play my fighting games and platformers, beat 'em ups, things like that. When I came to Japan, though, certain Japan exclusive fighting games, for example, the Hokuto no Ken fighting game by Arc System Works, I had never played. I knew of it, but that was just one that never got a release outside of Japan. So actually, my first day landing in Japan, the person who kind of met me at the airport and was my sponsor took me to a small local arcade. And as soon as I saw they had that game, because I'm a big fan of Arc's fighting games like Guilty Gear and Blaze Blue. And so when I saw that there, and I'm also a big fan of Hokuto no Ken, the anime series, Fist of the North Star. So when I saw that, I immediately just went down and sat and started playing that, jet lagged out of my mind, but I was like, I have to play this game right now. So things like that, stuff that did not get released outside of Japan was always fun to come across. Some of the machines with like the more elaborate peripherals of fighting, like a firefighting machine with like a giant hose or something to that effect, or an ambulance. Very similar to Crazy Taxi, but it's an ambulance instead. And so the cabinet has like giant ambulance lights on top of it, and you're driving through the city, very akin to Crazy Taxi. And again, the bullet hell shooters, because As a kid, most of the shooters I played were stuff like you could play on consoles, like Gradius or R-Type or UN Squadron, things like that. So when I sat down and got to try some of the Cave bullet hell shooters, and I think this was back in like 2010, so they had like just released Akai Katana and Dodonpachi Sai Daijo and Mushihime-sama Futari, these really very cool and very like visually just like stunning games, but like extremely difficult. I was kind of fascinated by the idea of a bullet hell because I was like, I'd never played something like that where they're just the entire screen is just filled with bullets and you're tasked with moving very incrementally your tiny little hitbox to navigate through all those bullets. So it felt like not just a shoot 'em up, but almost like a test of like your sort of attention to detail and patience and reflexes, almost like a puzzle element to it. I really started to enjoy those a lot. And I started playing them in arcades, and then after that, picked up as many as I could on consoles because they're kind of hard to come by. You could get them maybe on the Xbox 360. Some of them got released on the PS3, and then some of them more recently are getting released on the Switch, so I'm having fun with that. But I kind of discovered my love for that genre by playing them in arcades here.
Many arcade games are in a typical arcade cab, like an Astro City cab, for example, but Japan also has a lot of really unique ones as well. What are some of your favorite unorthodox arcade cabinets?
Like I said, the ambulance, which I, for the life of me, cannot remember the name of it though, but I like that one because the coloring of it, and it has the ambulance lights on it, and it makes noise and everything, and I just thought that was really cool. So I actually like to watch people play some of the rhythm games. I myself have no talent for that kind of game whatsoever, but it is fascinating to watch the people that it's almost mind-boggling how like fast their reflexes are and their hand-eye coordination. Where the screen might have sensors all around the screen, and they have to move their hands to all of them, or there's like a series of buttons in front of them that correspond to different like notes or whatever's happening on the screen, or even the ones where it's like a giant dance floor, and I don't necessarily know how it's working, but as the person is also sort of featured on the screen, it's kind of monitoring their motion, and as long as they're performing the right motions, they're like winning, they're scoring points. So I don't know how any of it really functions. Again, I don't really play them or have a talent for them, but they are very fascinating to watch someone else play them. So those are kind of cool. They have all kinds of really inventive ways to play those games that are just infinitely entertaining for me to watch. And I would say some of the like sit down shooters. There was, I think it was one of the more recent House of the Dead games, but like you get inside and you have like a large machine gun thing that you can control, or something like LA Machine Guns, where the gun is like so large that it has to be mounted onto the arcade cabinet itself. And as you're firing, it's just like rumbling in your arms. And I guess it's supposed to simulate what a real like mounted machine gun from a helicopter might feel like. Like those are always fun. Like these, those giant light gun games where you're just, again, I like it to keep it simple. So just point and shoot, always works for me. So stuff like that is always fun.
Yeah, one that automatically comes to mind for me is Sonic Blast Heroes, where you control the game by hitting a punching bag.
Oh,
It's a
yeah.
bit vague in how much your punches actually affect the gameplay, but it's just a great excuse to hit something really hard. Another personal favorite of mine is Budokai 1 from SNK. It's in your typical arcade cab, like an Astro City cab. It has a joystick and it has two buttons, left and right. And so you press the buttons to move your character and the joystick to attack. So it's kind of the opposite of most games.
You mentioning the Sonic Blast game, it actually brings to mind the one and only time I ever came across an original Street Fighter cabinet that had the giant buttons on
Oh.
it. That when you the harder you hit them, that dictates how the strength of your character's attack, and just what a horrible like it's kind of amusing at first, but eventually you're like, wow, this is terrible. I'd really love to just play a normal fighting game, but I was always wanted to try one of those. I knew they existed, never ever saw one in my life. And then right before they closed down the old Kawasaki Warehouse arcade, they had one of those in there. And so I finally got my chance to play it, and it was kind of fun for like 2 minutes. And then I was ready to go back to good old fashioned Street Fighter.
Yeah, I saw that original Street Fighter arcade cab at a Street Fighter exhibit last year, but there were many signs that said, do not touch this, because you either damage it or it would damage you. So it's a very funny, unorthodox thing. And of course, there's the Super Monkey Ball arcade game where the joystick is shaped like a banana. So there are many interesting cabs in Japan. Even though Japan probably has more arcade centers than anywhere in the world, there's been a lot of talk about their decline. Many prominent arcades have shut down these past few years. Why do you think the arcade business seems to be on the decline in Japan?
Well, I mean, a lot of these, the arcades that are closing down, in particular, some of the Sega ones that I'm aware of that closed down, or like I said, the Kawasaki Warehouse, those buildings are just so large. They're these big multi-storied buildings, 4 or 5 floors sometimes. And I just have to imagine the cost of operating them, the rent and the electricity has to be just monumental. And if you're not bringing in substantial amount of money, it's very easy to imagine those arcades shutting down. So, for example, 2 of the formerly Sega arcades in Akihabara have closed within the past, I want to say, 2.5 years. I think part of that is because those were 2 of the, like, in my opinion, not so good ones. One of them was one I never went to because it only had like prize redemption and crane games. There were no actual like video games to play. And the other one was very similar. So I think kind of like the main flagship one and the one that has Retro G and the one with all the pinball and stuff, I think those are able to stay afloat because they do have like enough games to attract people. And they are in an area where there's just a lot of people at any given time, especially now that international travel is opening back up. If you go to Akihabara right now, there'll be a lot of tourists walking around, and maybe a lot of them will have a desire to get into some of those arcades and try them out. So I feel like arcades like that, that are in like a good location, they have a lot of games to offer a variety of different gamers and you know, things like that. I think they'll be more or less okay. But as for the ones that are in locations where maybe there's not so much tourist traffic or there aren't quite so many people interested in going to an arcade to begin with, I just imagine the cost of operating them is so high that eventually it's just the only fiscally responsible thing to do would be close them down and maybe convert them into some other kind of business.
Final question. If you could have any Japanese arcade cab in your home, what would you pick?
Oh, boy. I might have to go just because there's so many things you could do with it. Maybe like an MVS system. because I, as a sometimes video game collector, I see the prices of games, and AES in particular, those games are just ridiculously expensive, thousands of dollars for each game sometimes. And oddly enough, the MVS games are typically the more affordable option. And I think there were a few different designs of the multi-video system. So there were like the 3-cartridge slot and the 5-cartridge slot. So I would want to have a 5-cartridge slot MVS machine. And then you can just pop in whatever 5 games you want at a time and then just play all those really great classic Neo Geo games. I'm a big fan of those. I like stuff like Metal Slug, Fatal Fury, King of Fighters, King of the Monsters, 8-Man, and Cyberlip, and Magician Lord. I'd have all that stuff ready to play, and I'd have my 5-cartridge MVS somewhere in my apartment. I don't know where find a spot for it, but that's probably what I would have at home, an MVS system.
All right, well, I'm glad I got to chat with you about this subject. Where can people find you?
You can find me as Kid Shoryuken on YouTube, on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook as well. And I'm probably going to keep the moniker Kid Shoryuken to make it easier for people to find me. Coming in 2023, probably around February or March timeframe, the name of my YouTube channel will actually be changing to Mad Panic Gaming. And it will still be, I'll still be referred to as Kid Shoryuken. And I think my little name plate there where it's like at Nantoka Nantoka. I think I'll still keep that as at Kitsuryukin, even though I will be doing like a little bit of a rebranding. But yeah, you can find me on all those social media sites.
Great. And listeners, the links to everything will be in the podcast description. Kitsuryukin, once again, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Once again, thanks to Kitsuryukin for chatting with me about Japanese arcades. Be sure to follow him on social media and check out his YouTube channel. Backlogs. We all have them. Some are bigger than others. And by backlog, I don't just mean games that we haven't beaten or barely played. I'm talking about games we paid money for, hard-earned money, but never touched. Never. And sad to say, I have a handful of games on my Switch that I have yet to touch, yet to boot up. Perhaps the most egregious of these is Pikmin 3 Deluxe, the 2020 remaster of the 2013 Wii U game. I think this was actually the last game EAD developed before they were merged into EPD, so it's a weirdly important title. The Deluxe game was also worked on by A-Ting. You might not know the name, but they've put out some notable titles like Bloody Roar, Kurukuru Kururin, Tatsunoko vs. Capcom, and many others. They are one of the many small-for-hire game developers in Japan. And they're Tokyo-based, so that's always a plus. As a big Nintendo fan, to have a Nintendo-developed game just sitting on your Switch untouched for months, that's pretty much a sin. Though, to be fair, I have a very complex relationship with the series. I bought Pikmin 1 at launch on the GameCube, so I was technically one of the first people to play Pikmin in the world in a relative sense. I played it, had some fun, but I did not like the timed mechanic. I talked about this in the Game of the Year episode, but as a kid and even into my teenage years, I really hated time sections in games because they stressed me out. I skipped Majora's Mask for years because of this. And due to this, I fell off Pikmin. But I have always liked the aesthetics, characters, and just idea of Pikmin. I'm glad it exists, but when Pikmin 2 and 3 came out, I just didn't care because I was not a fan of the time mechanic. However, I did get into Pikmin Bloom along with my wife. She's way more active in it than I am. I just keep forgetting to plant flowers because it saps my phone battery. But Pikmin is weirdly something that's part of our lives. I saw Pikmin 3 on sale for half off and thought I might as well grab it because I did hear it was a good co-op title, and it seems like something my wife would maybe like since we've already entered the Pikmin-verse. A few weeks ago, she just out of the blue said, "Let's play something on the Switch," and I thought, well, now is as good a time as any to give this Pikmin thing another shot. And I'm glad I did. Pikmin 3 Deluxe was an amazing experience from start to finish. The game follows a trio of astronauts who arrive on a planet to collect fruit for their homeworld. Their homeworld is called Koppai, which is a reference to Nintendo Koppai, the old name for Nintendo. So it is a fun inside joke. However, the astronauts don't have the smoothest of landings and thus also need to gather ship parts, save some other wayward souls, and eventually save the day. The story is fairly light, but there are some nice cutscenes and gibberish voice acting. Some light spoilers, but you do hear English later on in the game, and then I realized Pikmin got full voice acting before Pokemon, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, the point is that you need to gather fruit and other collectibles in the level, and to do so you need the help of Pikmin, small creatures with their own unique abilities. The Pikmin series is sort of Nintendo's take on an RTS. There's no base building or resource management, but you have a squad that you can use to explore areas, take out enemies, and to solve puzzles. It follows a very lock-and-key mechanic that you see in a lot of other games, such as Zelda. You need to get from A to B, and there's typically one way to do it. So figure it out. Though the puzzles have rigid solutions, the game offers a tremendous amount of freedom in terms of where to go on the map and what objectives you should focus on. The strength of the game is its incredibly dense levels and creative puzzles. Though each area is large, every little nook and cranny is filled with some secret or collectible. It's not space for the sake of space. Every little tunnel or alcove has a purpose. It's a real joy to just set off with your team and ordering Pikmin to do tasks along the way. Okay, you five carry this fruit, and then I need the yellow ones to fight this enemy, and I need to send the blue ones to go to this section that only they can traverse. When you get the hang of it and start multitasking, there's a great sense of accomplishment seeing the area become easier to navigate and the amount of treasures you grab start piling up. I was always excited to see what each little area had. There's a lot of Metroidvania-esque, you can't go here yet, but I get that limiting the stages the first go-round might make for a better, more directed experience. And when you do go back with all the Pikmin, with all the abilities, it feels like a whole new map. Whoa, I can go underwater now. And there's a ton of enemies I didn't even see the first go-around. This game is always wowing you with its secrets and charms. The structure of Pikmin 3 makes it feel like you're always achieving something, even if you don't complete the story objective in a day. Each day is timed, and after one day you consume one vial of fruit juice. I was concerned about this aspect, since while my hatred of time systems has lessened over the years, it's still not a game mechanic I'm crazy about. There's always the fear that I'm just going to dig myself into a hole that I can't crawl out of. But in Pikmin 3, the time mechanic is very, very generous. There's no set amount of days, so it doesn't feel like a hard timer. You do have a fruit juice supply, but just by playing the game and nabbing fruit you come across, you will have a huge juice buffer almost instantly. When I beat the game the first time, I had about 40 juice containers, meaning I could have played for 40 days without getting a single fruit if I wanted to. And I beat the game in 21 days, so yeah, the timer mechanic, just don't worry about it. I do have to wonder, is it even necessary in the grand scheme of the game? The fun of Pikmin 3 is exploring, collecting, and puzzle solving, not so much time management. I think you could easily get rid of the time mechanic as a whole and still create a compelling Pikmin game. Though the day-by-day aspect of your expedition does have some merit, it is fun to see your stats at the end of the day and to see the rocket launch off as you enjoy a much-needed rest. Outside of Pikmin 3's memorable premise and gameplay, the atmosphere and aesthetic is also iconic in its own right. It's both classic Nintendo in its design, but also a major deviation considering the locales of Pikmin are far more photorealistic than other Nintendo franchises. The dichotomy between the highly detailed world and objects with its simplistic and cartoonish characters is this franchise's unique calling card. Nintendo has been lapped several times over when it comes to making realistic graphics, so some may not be wowed by the locations in this game, but in terms of art direction and design, it still holds up. The soundtrack is also very diverse and catchy. The End of the Day tune will be stuck in your head, as will the spaceship theme. The OST in general is just a good thing to put on in the background. Lo-fi Pikmin beats to chill and study to. As I mentioned earlier, I played co-op with my wife, and if you can get a co-op buddy, I think this is the best way to experience Pikmin 3 Deluxe. I was reading up on what changed from 3 to Deluxe, and the original Wii U game didn't even have co-op. That seems crazy to me since this game works so well in co-op mode, and it feels like the game was designed around it. There's even a character switching mechanic, so it is a bit baffling that Nintendo didn't aim for co-op the first go-around. But I think maybe the map was really gamepad-reliant, which hampers cooperative play. I'm just glad we're on the Switch now. Anyways, the core mechanics of the game are easy enough for anyone to figure out. The controls do take some getting used to, and can be a bit cumbersome. There will be a lot of accidental Pikmin throwing, or screwing up when swapping characters. But when it works, it works. We could split up, do different tasks, then reconvene to do the story mission or whatever. I couldn't help but laugh when we randomly bumped into each other in the overworld while we were doing our own things. It's fun to play together and just play next to each other. Did my wife accidentally set off bombs that killed half the Pikmin? Or fail to dodge a boss attack that resulted in the same thing? Yes. But hey, it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. You can always get more Pikmin, so don't worry if half of them die off instantly. If you can, Pikmin 3 co-op is probably the best way to experience the game. It's something I hope they bring back for Pikmin 4. Maybe online co-op? I was clocked at finishing the story mode at 7.5 hours, but in reality, it was probably a bit longer. To be honest, I felt like it ended abruptly. The story wrapped up and everything, but I felt like I was just starting to get good at the game. Once you get all the Pikmin types, the game ends soon after. After you beat the game, you can roll back a few days and hop across levels to get all the fruit and collectibles, but the game certainly pushes you to keep focusing on the story objective first and foremost. It kind of feels like I got some awesome new weapon, but I was only able to use it on the final boss. With games these days that feel like they go on forever, Pikmin 3 surprised me in that it was one I didn't want to end. They could have transitioned into 5 more completely new stages and I'd be totally up for it. But the game does have more content than you'd think. There are side stories starring Olimar. The format isn't the more laid-back, make-your-own-objective type of gameplay of the main story. Instead, you have a very strict time limit with one goal, and you've got to figure out how to do it while racking up points in order to get the medals. Nothing carries over between days, so these are more isolated challenges where you focus less on building up your team and more on doing specific tasks. There's Olimar's assignment, which takes place before the events of the game, and Olimar's comeback, which is sort of an epilogue. The first takes about an hour to complete, and the second maybe two or more, but it does encourage replayability with the scoring system. Due to their more strict format, these missions are more challenging than the main game, and a good way to utilize your Pikmin skills that you've honed throughout the story. You can start the first side story at any time, but I highly recommend you hold off until you beat the game. Both are absolutely worth going through. There's also mission mode, which is similar to the side stories in format. The missions are broken up by tasks, such as getting fruit, defeating enemies, boss rush, etc. I'm more of a fan of the whole carry a big banana thing the game has, so I went through all the treasure missions. There are 15 total, and surprisingly, the last 5 missions are completely original maps. There's a junkyard, there's a birthday party, even a futuristic factory. These are not too difficult, but if you want the platinum medal, you need to know every inch of the map. But even if you just play them once and forget it, the map layouts are diverse, and these missions really push your multitasking skills. The side content is fairly meaty, but I think they are likely to be ignored by most people who typically just go through the story mode once and forget about it. But like with Metroid, Pikmin is a game where you need to 100% it to get the most out of the game and understand its strengths and what the developers are aiming for. I got 38 out of 66 fruit my first go-around, but I rolled back a few days, got all the fruit, then beat the game again to get the quote-unquote perfect ending, which is really just a 30-second narration. There is something so satisfying about collecting the fruit. They're just so big, and the animation where you fill up the juice containers is pure ASMR. The boss battles, which are appropriately huge and epic, are wonderful set pieces, and are highlighted by the fact that when you beat it, there's always 3 or 4 gigantic things you need to carry back to your nest. It's a nice breather. Okay, we crushed that horrible monster, now gather up these kiwis and its corpse, and let's go home. I didn't like the final mission at all my first time around, but it's certainly more manageable once you know exactly what to do. Still not a huge fan of it, though. According to the game clock, it took me about 3 more hours to get the fruit I missed, so my playtime went from 7.5 hours to 11 hours. That's still pretty short, but add in all the side content and you can easily get 15 plus hours out of this game. After playing the game, Pikmin 4 has pretty much become a day one purchase for me. I'm excited to see where they take the franchise, especially since 3 came out in 2013. That's 10 years ago. Is Pikmin 3 a retro game? Maybe. Now it's time to make the big mainstream push for Pikmin, similar to what happened with Kirby last year. Japan has been getting a new influx of Pikmin merch with the new Pikmin 4-styled logo, so I can definitely see Nintendo pushing it hard. Deluxe alone sold about 2.3 million units, more than any other Pikmin game. Maybe now is the time to shoot for 5 million. We don't have a whole lot of details on Pikmin 4, but we know it has an over-the-shoulder camera. I'm curious how this is going to work since a lot of the gameplay revolves around seeing the entire area around you and multitasking. The over-the-shoulder camera has some advantages, though, in that it does make things look big, and small things actually being huge is part of the gimmick of Pikmin. The controls and UX also take some getting used to, so I think Nintendo could definitely streamline a lot of those elements. I had a great time with Pikmin 3, so I highly recommend it. I regret not giving the franchise another chance earlier, though actually maybe it's a good thing I got into Pikmin 3 now, because the next game is only a few months away. If I tried this on the Wii U, I'd be waiting a decade, so being a latecomer is good sometimes. A few episodes ago, I gave some thoughts on Tactics Ogre Reborn, the remaster of the PSP remake of the original SNES game. Normally, if I cover a game more than once, I wait until I beat it. But I'm going to be honest, Fire Emblem Engage comes out in a few days, and I will likely be obsessed with it, so I think I will put Tactics Ogre on the back burner for a while. But I have progressed quite a bit since the last time I talked about the game, so for the first time ever in the history of the podcast, here are my mid-game thoughts. Currently, I'm deep in Chapter 3, which is a bit over the halfway mark, but a lot of content seems to unlock near the end of the game, so there's likely more than I think. Since my last update, I've grown my team quite a bit. I was able to recruit a dragon and a griffin thanks to the cool Beastmaster class, and now I have a much-needed ninja. Every SRPG team needs some sort of ninja or thief to jump high, do critical damage, and just clean house before they get completely destroyed because you overextended. The classes in Tactics Ogre are not amazing on paper. I mean, they are what you'd expect. Knight, mage, healer, etc. I can't blame the game for not having some sort of wild, out-of-the-box class, since every game essentially copied this one and built upon it. But all of them still feel distinct and fill some role in the greater metagame. Once you start learning more passive skills, you are able to pull off a lot of fun things like instantly buffing your team or debuffing the enemy. I've been using a dragon, which isn't as strong as I assumed, but it's a good tank character with cool AoE attacks. Plus, it can throw a boulder, something I didn't know dragons could do. I do wish there were more classes. I know you unlock some more later, but one thing that isn't gelling with me completely is the very linear, strict progression. The game has a level cap dictated by the story, so there's no way to grind a level or two to get the edge on a tough map, despite having infinite training maps for you to mess around in. Since skills are level locked, it does feel like the game only wants you to enter the battle with a specific type of mage or a specific build for your Terror Knight. SRPGs often have to ride the balance between strategy and RPG. If you make it too strategy focused, it just feels like chess, with little emphasis on customization or freedom in the gameplay. If it's too much in the RPG area, though, it becomes too easy to grind past the strategy part, and then you are just mindlessly pushing your guys forward as they destroy everything. Tactics Ogre certainly leans a bit more into the strategy part, which some people may prefer. Honestly, I do wish they weren't so restrictive when it comes to the levels or the classes. I have 12 people on my team, and some of them have duplicate classes. Ideally, everyone would be a different class, right? Especially since character builds aren't as open as, say, Final Fantasy Tactics. But as a pure strategy game, it's hard but fair. I fought one battle where I got totally creamed, but I tried it again with the exact same team, with nothing changed, but managed to win due to more careful planning. So some battles that may seem insurmountable actually aren't, and it's up to you to figure out how to use your team effectively and manipulate the enemies. The game has a rewind mechanic, so even if you make a stupid mistake or two, it's not the end of the world. The game rewards patience and effective tactics, though it may take a while before you figure out what the map wants you to do. I'm also enjoying how grounded the story is. There's no magic MacGuffin, no crazy Dark Lord, it's just a war between nations and you're caught in the middle. The core of the story is between the main character and his sister, something more small scale than I expected. Though the world has its share of lore and is filled with dozens of named characters, I think focusing on this one specific relationship is a smart decision and an interesting premise. It feels very personal, despite all the castle raiding and burning villages. Playing this game, you could obviously see its influence in many other titles, both SRPG and not. I mean, Final Fantasy XVI is probably a branch of the Tactics Ogre tree. It's the father of Final Fantasy Tactics, the game that made all of us like this genre in the first place. Triangle Strategy from last year also owes a tremendous amount to this game in terms of its tone and story. You can't help but respect what this game achieved. I mean, it even predates A Song of Ice and Fire by a year. This is a game I could see myself chipping away at throughout the year. Fire Emblem is coming up, which definitely has a lot more going on in terms of what you can do. And there's also the heavily rumored Final Fantasy Tactics Remaster, which may hit in 2023. Plus, a bunch of other tactics games like the upcoming Metal Slug Tactics, and oh yeah, I need to play Midnight Suns. But even with all that competition, I can see myself returning to Tactics Ogre every now and then. I do think this title is more suited towards the hardcore SRPG fans. If you're a casual SRPG player or want to get into the genre, I think Fire Emblem or the earlier Nippon Ichi SRPGs are a better entry point. But if you've gone through FFT, gone through Fire Emblem, and want something a bit more old school and heavy on the S part of SRPG, I think there's definitely a lot to like about Tactics Ogre Reborn. That's it for games, now for the news. Alright, let's check out some news. But before that, I want to do a little mini feature on two places I visited recently in Tokyo. The first is Mother Museum, which is an art exhibit in Shibuya Parco. This showcases scenes from the Mother franchise, aka Earthbound. Not really scenes, but more background art. Think of all the iconic places in the franchise. They even have the Mani Mani statue there, live and in person. But thankfully, it's behind protective glass, so its evil is contained. The cool thing about this exhibit is that you can see the entire setting in just one picture. So all of Allnet's buildings are in this one frame. The layout is really nice. As I mentioned before, it has both Foreside and Moonside. However, the Foreside has a white background, and Moonside, of course, has a black background on the wall. So they put a lot of thought and creativity into how they lay out these iconic places. However, I've only played Mother 2, aka Earthbound, so I mostly gravitated towards those images. Of course, it has an extensive merch area as well, with the highlight being the super plush bear, which is a new item. I went to an Earthbound exhibit maybe 1 or 2 years ago, and it has a lot of the same merchandise, like a lot of Mr. Saturn plushies, and a lot of more avant-garde or kind of prestige items. There's towels, there's art books. You can even buy the script of all three Mother games in this really nice box set. And the best part is that it's free, although I guess they make most of their money on the Mr. Saturn plushies. The other exhibit I visited is Mika Picasso's art exhibit in Shibuya. Like the Mother Museum, it's free, so great for me. If you don't know who Mika Picasso is, I think you will probably pretty soon because she is the character designer of the upcoming Fire Emblem Engage. I believe she became most famous because of her VTuber art. However, I hadn't heard of her until Fire Emblem. She has this really vivid, colorful art style, and there are some cool pieces where you need to take a flash photo of this black square, and then when you check your phone, oh, the art actually shows up on there. This was much, much more crowded than the Mother Museum. I think she has many, many fans. Her designs are pretty unorthodox for Fire Emblem, but a lot of people do like the new design, so I'm interested to see how they translate into the world of Fire Emblem. There's a duo of upcoming indie game events in Tokyo. The first is Tokyo Indie Game Summit on March 4th. This will be held in Kichijoji, which is kind of unorthodox for an indie game event. However, it is a really nice neighborhood and a good place to visit, so I don't mind hopping over there every now and then. It does have some major sponsors like Bandai Namco and Cygames. It's the first time ever they're holding the event, so I'm curious to see how it differs from the other indie game events like Digital Games Expo and Tokyo Game Dungeon. Also, Tokyo Sandbox in Akihabara will be on April 15th. This is its 7th year, and there will be over 60 exhibitors. I can't promise I'll visit every single indie game event in Tokyo, but I'll definitely try to get to a lot of them. I really enjoyed my time at the Digital Games Expo, but I think that one is probably the biggest one in Tokyo, or at least one of the bigger ones. Tokyo Game Dungeon is actually happening right now if you're listening to the podcast on day one, so I don't have any report from that yet. But next episode, I'll give some thoughts if I'm able to attend it. No promises. Pocket Card Jockey Ride On is coming to Apple Arcade on January 20th. What is this? It's a remake and or port of Pocket Card Jockey for the 3DS. This game is notable because the developer is Game Freak, none other than the creators of Pokemon. But they do have an extensive catalog of non-Pokemon games, especially before they invented Pokemon. It seems to be Apple Arcade exclusive for now, but I'm sure a Switch version will come eventually. Game Freak's relationship with Nintendo can be pretty odd at times. You would think they would give Nintendo first priority on everything, but they really don't. Another of their indie titles, Giga Wrecker, launched on Steam in early access and then later came to the Switch. And of course, there's the fairly infamous Timbo game, which launched in 2015. It was on Steam, PlayStation, Xbox, not the Wii U. And they gave quite a silly reason for this. Basically, the art designer, James Turner, said he drew a mock-up and then drew the logos, like a Steam logo and a PlayStation logo, but he didn't make a Wii U logo, so the game wasn't ported to Wii U. That's a pretty weak excuse, just be honest. Or just say, we're currently focusing on these platforms right now. I do wonder why it's only launching on Apple Arcade first. Typically, if there's an Apple Arcade exclusive, some money has changed hands. But does Game Freak really need that money? Are they starving for cash? Either way, Pocket Card Jockey is a pretty well-regarded game, and I didn't play the 3DS version, so I might try the Apple Arcade version. I've actually never dipped my toe in the Apple Arcade waters. However, there are a few games I want to try out, like Pocket Card Jockey, Amazing Bomberman, and I believe they still have that Choo Choo Rocket game there as well. So maybe in a future episode, I will have a focus on Apple Arcade, so look forward to it. PlayStation recently announced Project Leonardo, which is a new PlayStation controller. It's something I would describe as an accessibility controller and aimed at gamers with disabilities. It looks like a gigantic circle with huge buttons. You can swap out the buttons and even assign special commands like L2 and R2 to a single button. I think it's really great how a lot of hardware makers like Sony and Microsoft have gone out of their way to make more accessible controllers. I have to imagine these don't sell a whole lot, but it opens up the gates for people who normally don't play games to get a chance to actually interact with them. However, Nintendo really doesn't do any accessibility thing, right? There's no accessible version of the Pro Controller. I guess you could argue the Joy-Cons and motion controls give people a bit of versatility when it comes to playing games and giving them unique input methods, but there's nothing really aimed at disabled gamers. Hopefully, Nintendo focuses on this audience in the future. Instax Mini Link is getting a Splatoon version on January 19th. If you're not sure what this is, it's basically a smartphone printer. However, they have some Nintendo collaborations. There was a new Pokemon Snap version with a blue and red kind of Switch design. The Splatoon version has a more purple design, and the button is shaped a bit different from the new Pokemon Snap version. And if you ever see my podcast promo art, I use this to print out the photos. It's pretty good as a smartphone printer. It is a bit pricey, about $100, but if you're going to print out photos, well, this is the thing you need. It also comes with like a green squid cover, which I guess you can put on it for whatever reason. Last bit of news, Yusuke Kozaki, one of the former Fire Emblem character designers who worked on Awakening and Fire Emblem Fates, recently revealed that he also designed Pokemon for Scarlet and Violet, specifically Varum, Revarum, Sitadel, and Sedotan. Sitadel is easily one of the better designs in the game, and Scarlet and Violet, even though it has quite a bit of flaws, definitely has a lot of excellent new Pokemon. I mean, that's a great email to get. Hey, can you design some Pokemon? I really enjoyed his Fire Emblem art, and I think his more modern art style really helped push Fire Emblem into the mainstream. So I definitely think he has a strong connection with Nintendo. I'd love to see him design more Pokemon, or maybe something else in the future as well. Now for the Japanese gaming phrase of the week. This week's phrase is shodouke, shodouke. This is a term describing games that make the bulk of their sales in the first week and don't have a lot of legs. Many JRPGs fall under this, but it's definitely a term that's not often used for Nintendo games, especially in the Switch era. When I hear shodouke, I think of the Simple series of games back in the PS2 days, where they just churned out game after game. Just get it out and then focus on the next one. Once again, shodouke. And the Japanese tweet of the week. I picked one from Game Tsurugaya. Yes, the official Twitter of the Tsurugaya Used Games Shop, which I talked about on this podcast earlier. Recently, it seems like they got a rather large stock of unopened Nintendo games, including a lot of Game Boy titles and classics like Donkey Kong Jungle Beat. I don't know how they got these or if they committed some sort of elaborate heist, but if you want to buy brand new Game Boy titles in the year 2023 at a reasonable price, it is possible at Tsurugaya. Most of the games are pretty obscure, but discovering old games is part of the fun of retro hunting. As always, the tweet is in the description. And we're done. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It really helps with visibility. The podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on January 29th. A rare third episode in 1 month. Prepare for some Fire Emblem talk. See you next time. Matane!